Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening as we begin another week's worth of shows. We rely on the biomedical research community to produce objective studies that can be used by doctors and their patients to, we hope, promote better health for everyone. Increasingly, though, there is concern among people who do this research, among the people who read it and who publish it. There's concern that there are powerful conflicts of interest that may indeed undermine the integrity of biomedical research. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with one of this country's leading advocates for scientific integrity. His name is Drummond Rennie. He is deputy editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. He is also adjunct professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He's visiting here at the campus of the University of Illinois to be a featured speaker for this year's Symposium on Graduate Education. His keynote address is titled, Who Wrote My Paper, R&R in Academia? And it will explore issues including authorship and peer reviewing and the influence of commercial sponsors. He'll be talking this afternoon at 1 o'clock. This takes place at the Illini Union in rooms B and C, and at least the conference begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And if you're interested, I think that it's open to anyone. The event is free. They do recommend people register in advance. It may be too late for that, but it's probably okay if you just want to stop by and take in the talk. Questions here on the program, of course, are also welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. If you're listening over the air and on the internet, anywhere in the country, the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm sure there are a number of things that we can talk about, but as a general question, are you worried about the kind of research that's being done today, or perhaps what ends up being reported to the public?
The answer to both is yes. There are several questions here. There are several problems here. First of all, who's setting the agenda? And then who's paying the piper? And it's the same people. So we're getting what commercial interest decides we should get. And this isn't at all necessarily, it isn't necessarily what we need. Hmm. The studies we need, which often focus on subjects which have little value for drug companies, just aren't investigated at all, whereas pills, which may be Me Too pills, are heavily investigated and partially reported. Mm-hmm. I find this, and many of my colleagues find this, very troubling. And by the way, I should say I speak for myself alone here. Mm-hmm. I'm not representing the University of California or anyone else or my journal.
Well, I am certain, though, that there are many people that would share your concerns. Is it possible to make this a little bit more concrete and give an example?
Yes. Here's an example. If I go, clinical trials decide about the worth of specific treatments, and they're very carefully designed to do exactly that. If I go into a cocktail party, does anyone hold cocktail parties now? I've heard about them.
I'm never invited to such things.
No, nor I. But anyhow, if you go into a room full of people and explain the following, they have no difficulty understanding it. And that is, that if you report only those trials that have favorable results, and you don't report any of the harms, then you're going to get a distorted view of the value of the new pill. A very distorted view. That's obvious to everybody, to the public. It's even obvious to me. However, if you try and explain that one to clinical researchers who are taking money from the sponsors, they say to me, Drummond, it's not as simple as that. And so we say, we have the following sophisticated argument. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. And that's it. Now, what do you do about this? Now, in 2000, I and two others managed to get some pharmaceutical executives into a room at the O'Hare Hilton, which is where you fly in the morning, have a day of hell, and then fly out feeling exhausted. And we spent the whole day trying to do one simple thing, trying to get these executives to agree that when they started a trial, they would register it. They would agree to the setting up of a registry which would record what the trial was about, its existence. Now, what would that do? It would mean that anyone who treated patients and relied, say, on reviews of the subject would know that the reviewer, the physician looking into this, knew about all the trials. And if 10 trials had been done and only one had been reported, the only one that showed things worked well for the drug, then that person would know about it, be able to find all the results, would be able to know whom to go to get the results, or at any rate could say, look, hey, 10 trials were done and only one's been reported. And that's a bit different from saying the trial that has been done shows that everything works wonderfully without anyone knowing about the other 9. They said it'll be a cold day in hell before this ever happens. And as usually happens when you file out of the room like that, you mutter hostile statements like, we'll make you do it. Well, it's happened. Editors have just decided that they won't publish papers unless they've been registered. And large registries have been set up. So if you're interested in a particular subject, you can look into these registries and see how many trials are being done, who's doing them, and so on, and what the aim is, and so on. Now, another thing happened, and this, however, was by far more than the efforts that my pathetic efforts and those of my colleagues. The following happened. There are a class of drugs, let's just call them, they're called SSRIs. They're supposed to help people with depression. They may do, they may not. They may help some and not others. Depression is a terrible disease, and when it happens in kids or in adults, the onset of a severe depression that takes you to a doctor is it's a dangerous time. We know that that moment is a time when suicide tends to occur. It tended to occur before there were any drugs, and it tends to occur now that there are drugs. When it happened, there were certain cases where lawsuits were brought because the parents, the weeping parents, having this dreadful tragedy of their kid committing suicide, that kid had just been put on these drugs. Now, it's a very difficult thing proving or not proving scientifically, let alone in law, whether that's the case. But the then Attorney General, the State's Attorney, Elliot Spitzer of New York, said, In a sense, I don't care about the scientific issue. Scientists are going to argue about that forever. But I do care that the fact that the discovery process involved in law revealed the existence of a whole lot of trials which showed many harms coming from these drugs, but the results had been suppressed. And he said, and I think we can all get behind this, I don't know much about the science, but I do know that's wrong. That these parents and the child's doctors would have been enormously more informed and importantly informed if they'd known the results of those trials. Would they have let their kid have the drug? They were never given the option. The doctor was never given any knowledge whatsoever of the bad effects. He said that he sued one of the drug companies, and this was in 2004, and said, you have to register the trials. We have to know all those trials out there. And within days, many of the large companies were saying, we always meant to register, we're going to do it. And then they have spent a good deal of time confusing the issue, setting up registries that say, well, what is the drug? And you'll read them and it says, investigational drug. Not the chemical, not the name of the drug, just investigational drug. So there are a lot of shenanigans going on like that. But the fact is, it's much better now in the last 3 or 4 years. A lot of trials have been registered, and slowly the companies are beginning to realize it's a good idea. And if you think about it, it's an interesting thing that happens, because companies are built of people. And it's a well-known, I know I'm not a sociologist or psychiatrist, but people gather around two sorts of table. They gather around a table at work, surrounded by the building, and they reach decisions. And then though you can guarantee that those decisions would be quite different if they gathered around with their teenage kids and their wife or husband, because the same decision would seem completely immoral. A decision not to register is an immoral or unethical one. It's completely unethical because it's saying we're going to hide the bad stuff. Would you ever make that decision at home? I don't think so, because you'd have your gaping teenagers saying, are you crazy? Are you crazy? I think the term is called moral disengagement, where we get round a table of our team at work and we decide something that's outrageous. Something that we just can't defend in front of our teenagers. And basically, if you can't defend it in front of your kid, it's not worth defending.
Let me just reintroduce our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit. Dr. Drummond Rennie. He is the deputy editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. He is adjunct professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco. He was a member of the Commission on Research Integrity to the Public Health Service, and he's taken a leading role in the debate on research misconduct. He's here visiting the campus, going to be giving the keynote address at this year's Symposium on Graduate Education. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This situation that you described, this is just not a hypothetical. This has happened, and we now have good evidence to know that this indeed has happened, that we have an experimental medication, it goes into trials, and the results that end up being reported are the positive results, and the negative results end up being buried. To what extent do we lay that at the door of the pharmaceutical company, or to what extent have researchers, in fact, been complicit in bearing the bad results?
That's an excellent question, and this has been thoroughly investigated. First of all, there are many bars to publication, including journals like myself. We only publish 5-6% of what we receive. But we do know that pretty well everything we reject goes to smaller journals and is eventually published. That's the first thing. We know from many studies now that between 93 and 94% of all studies that are not published, it is a decision on the part of the authors. So then you say, well, is it the authors or is it their sponsors? And the problem is they become the same thing by the passage of money. Because you have 10, 20, 30, 40 people working with you and for you. You have to pay their salaries. You've been in this big trial. The trial's not showing good results. You all feel that you want to get on with life. You would much rather not report it. And the sponsors are thrilled if you don't support it, if you don't report it. I apologize. If you don't report it. Moreover, you know that the sponsors will re-sponsor you even more readily, or let's say much more readily, if you don't report it. So everybody has a sort of conspiracy of silence there, and they get on with the next thing, and the bad stuff is somehow slid sideways and falls off the desk and disappears into that heap in the corner. Mm. Now, a lot of this goes, these results are supposed to go to the FDA, but the FDA is in such a mess and their surveillance system is so poor and so underfunded that it's just not going to be followed up on.
It seems also to be the case, and I know that this is something that you've looked at and I think have published on it in the journal, is that journals apparently are more, I don't know if it's that they're more likely to publish or they do in a more timely fashion, articles that deal with positive results, and that what you really want to do is publish something that says drug X, fabulous result. It seems that one is less inclined to publish a story that says drug X, maybe it works a little bit for some people, but basically it doesn't really do anything.
Yeah. We, that is my colleagues, myself, the chief person was Kay Dickerson at Hopkins. My name is on the papers because we looked into this very carefully. And we found that the proportion of papers that we published with positive results was exactly the same as the proportion of papers that we received with positive results. So that we know we are always publishing, or not, we publish quite a few studies with negative results where it didn't work out. And we've had a lot of discussion about this, published a lot of papers on this, so that we don't feel bad about that. We think we, editors, at any rate, go more or less to the quality of the paper. And we get very jumpy about publishing strongly positive results anyway, because there's a ton of evidence to say that when miracles happen, they aren't.
We have a caller here, I think, on our toll-free line and Matt Toon. Why don't we bring them into the conversation here? They're on our line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello? Is the caller there? Go ahead. No, I think maybe we have a little bit of a problem. Well, maybe if the caller would bear with us, we'll see if we can figure out what our problem is, and we'll get them on the air. And, of course, other people who are listening are welcome to call, too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's try again here in Mattoon. Hello. Well, again, I'm not quite sure what the problem is. We'll see if we can get that straightened out, and we'll be happy to take calls here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. I suppose that some people would suggest that one way to get around the problem that you've talked about would be for the funders of the research to have no interest in, no stake at all in the outcome. And I suppose one could only think of, say, perhaps nonprofit research foundations or the federal government as being the source of that kind of money, where they don't really care whether drug X works or not, because they're not going to make any money whether off of drug X. Is it reasonable to think that such a thing could happen, or do they simply not have that kind of money, and do we find ourselves having to fall back on the money from... And I suppose here, basically, if we're talking about prescription medications, we're talking about large pharmaceutical companies that have an interest in the outcome.
Well, it's thoroughly reasonable. You have to say, what are public goods? I don't like paying taxes. And I like to have, I'd love it if I had a strong hand on what I paid taxes for. Mm-hmm. However, we're talking about life or death here. We're talking about what I think is a public good. Now, I strongly support, we know that most drug advances, the basic research, comes on government money, comes on taxpayer money through NIH and National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health money. I am thrilled if my colleagues make money on developing those molecules that are discovered, that they've discovered, new enzymes, whatever it is. That's a good way of doing things. They should make money from it. And ever since 1980, the Bayh-Dole Act, they've been able to do so, and their institutions have too. However, what I think is absurd on the face of it, is to have the people who sponsor the drug in charge of the testing of the drug in humans. It's at that point where I say, come on, because we have a massive evidence in scores, I'd say even hundreds of studies now, that show the bias in favor of the manufacturer. Massive bias, so that we're getting false information. And it would seem to me that the only thing one could have would be to have a National Institute of Clinical Trials separate from the FDA, definitely separate from the FDA, and it would contract out to various institutions like this one, like UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, whatever, say, you do the trial. This is the money you get for it. You don't get more. You don't get less. That's it. You don't get money for teaching engagements. You don't get money for phony continuing medical education. This is what you get for doing the trial. And that's a trial that several things would happen. But the best thing of all would be it would have high credibility. Very high credibility. Journals would love to publish it. The companies whose drugs worked out well in trials like that should be ecstatic. And managed care organizations, for example, would love to know that sort of stuff. Now, who pays? I think it should go through the government. We've had this experiment since 1992 or 3, whereby the drug companies, in order to speed things through the FDA, pay money. And they'd say they pay a lot of money. The act is called PDUFA, the Prescription Drug Utilization Federal Act or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it ensures a complete breakdown of a system of keeping you and me and everyone out there safe. Because the moment, even though the drug company money is a minority of what they get, small minority, and even if that total amount is piddling by, say, stealth bomber standards, it changes the culture of a place completely. Because suddenly, drug company people can go into the FDA and say, we're paying your salary. We've got your attention. And we're directing this operation. And that's more or less what's been happening. And more than that, it's been reducing their their principal task is the safety of the public. And they have reduced their safety part, the surveillance and safety of drugs, to a tiny, tiny cadre of people, which is a great way of destroying a wonderful organization. And, of course, it's highly dispiriting to everybody there. So the money from the drug companies has to be taken away from the FDA. We have to pay that sort of thing ourselves. We have to. We're already paying for the molecules to be developed. We have to pay for the testing of the drugs.
Let's talk to some people who are listening here. They're all here where we are in Champaign-Urbana. Let's start here with line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Drummond, you really speak the truth with a sober indignation, but with lines like, if you can't defend it against your kids, it isn't worth defending. You could come to any cocktail party that I would have. I would be considered an apprentice in the academic knowledge industries, and I do critical studies of sports. So a lot of what I'm looking at is discourses about steroids. And I wondered if you could maybe expand your discussion to talk about some of the perils we face in the social sciences as well, where we have the same problems of the corporatization of the university are also affecting those sort of knowledge productions. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on some of the other areas that are affected by, as you say, the FDA being a mess. There's a lot of other areas of the government that would also be considered that.
Thank you. That really broadens it out, doesn't it? I'm not a sociologist, clearly. I'm not quite sure what I am. I'm a kidney doctor, but I don't see patients any longer. And I'd say that what has happened in my life, I started when I was at Harvard, and I was the deputy editor of the New England Journal, and that started in 1977, so that's 31 years ago. And then we never asked ever if any paper, whether it be chemical or sociological, we never thought about its funding. We never had to. Everything changed in 1980 when, for very, very good reasons, research was speeded up by giving researchers and their institutions some of the action. They could get patents, etc. This had an enormous effect. It speeded up research. It made people enthusiastic, and it made very rich. That's called the Bayh-Dole Act that I referred to of 1980. But there's this downside, and the downside is that, well, I'm invited to New York to give a talk to the American Society on Hypertension, and the head of the president of the society said, I don't know what to do. My society is awash with drug company money, and you can't get a straight answer out of anyone. I don't know how much the same thing is happening in the broader area of sociological research or in sports research or in sports itself. I read the papers. That's all I know about it. And if you can pay for it, you can pretty much get it. Mm. But I don't have a deeper insight than that.
Mm-hmm. It would not surprise me, though, in other sorts of scholarly journals to see the kinds of problems that you point to in biomedical publishing, the same sorts of issues with peer review and is that a good system and conflicts of interest and what gets published and what doesn't get published, and perhaps also your concern and your conclusion that a paper, sooner or later, you can find someone to publish almost anything.
Yeah. Well, what we don't like is, as happened just the other day, we thought, this is a good paper. It's wonderful, actually. It's a beautiful trial. Well done. But then came the question, can we believe a word of it? Because every single person there was heavily indebted to the sponsors. The same thing happens. It's not just drugs. It's nutrition. It's nutraceuticals, which the lady may have been referring to, that sort of thing, which are more or less uncontrolled. And there's a laugh or a cry. Mm-hmm. It's the same, you see, all that with matters dealt with by the EPA to do with pollution and so on, that you don't know whether you're dealing with a scientific paper or an advertorial.
Well, let's go on and talk with some other folks who are listening here. We're also a bit past the midpoint, and perhaps, again, I should very quickly reintroduce the guest, Dr. Drummond Rennie. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving the keynote address for this year's Symposium on Graduate Education. He is deputy editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. He is adjunct professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco. He is indeed an MD doctor and a kidney specialist. That was his area of practice and interest. He's was a member of the Commission on Research Integrity to the Public Health Service, and has taken a prominent role in this kind of debate that we're having here this morning, the debate upon misconduct in research, or perhaps just problems with the way that research is done and how it is that research is published. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Next up here is the line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to say I found it's a good alternative resource. Not that I don't take my doctor's advice, but I looked to Worst Pills, Best Pills by Wolf, which gives me a lot of good information, and they're more objective about some of these drugs that are being pushed that shouldn't be. And I also worry about the fact that a lot of the doctors in different departments, like my gastroenterologist, doesn't coordinate with psychiatrists on my reactions to certain drugs, because it's a real personal thing. Everybody's different. Unfortunately, the insurance companies don't allow you much time in the doctor's office to do that. What are we going to do to solve that problem? Thanks.
All right, thank you. This gets at the issue of what individuals can do for themselves. As we urge them to be informed consumers of other things, we say, you know, be careful when you're going to go to buy a fridge. When it comes to prescription medications, their doctor may say, here, go ahead and take this medicine. It's going to be much more difficult for them to say, well, I'm not sure that that's the right thing, or can you assure me that that this is the right thing? How do you think consumers it seems maybe inappropriate almost to use that word, but when people are thinking of their own health and they're talking with their doctors about these very questions, how do people approach this?
Well, skepticism, which the last lady expressed, is a really good approach. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know the book or I think you're talking Sidney Wolf, right?
I'm not sure. I could look it up.
Who's a tremendous crusader, very smart, and he and Peter Lurie and various people like that, there are various groups that are throwing a good deal of light into these dark areas of medicine. I can't say anything about how doctors coordinate with each other. I'm lucky. My doctor coordinates beautifully with a whole lot of people. That's such an individual matter, and I can't solve that one.
Yes, it is indeed Sidney Wolfe that is the author of the book that the caller was talking about, Worst Pills, Best Pills.
Yeah, he's a very smart person, and his group are very smart, and I just gave them an ad.
Is there more reason to be concerned about a medication that has not been in general use for very long? If the doctor says, or somehow you get the idea that something that he or she is prescribing is the latest thing, hot off the presses, should you be more concerned than if this is a medication that has been on the market for several years?
Yes. David, you're absolutely on the button. I ask members of my family, certainly me, said, don't ever use a drug unless it's been around 5 years or more. I mean, it works like this. You do a clinical trial, and you have, say, a couple, two or three clinical trials. In all, you may, if you're lucky, have had 2,000 people on the drug. But if the if it causes a mortality 1 in 1,000, then you may lose the fact that two people died because that's not statistically significant, but that's a lot of dead people if it gets out to several million. That's the sort of Vioxx story. And other toxic effects. So I think it's really smart to be the last to get the new drug.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller on line 3. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. Very interesting subject, and I really admire your guest for his crusade. What about transparency in this subject? Because I know the general public is not too well versed in the literature on the papers being published, much less the ones that are rejected and/or improperly researched, or you know, tied into all the money tied into this deal. And as you mentioned in your earlier comment about when you started this business, there was no discussion of funding or money about whether it did the drug work or not. That was, you know, and its trials and everything else. And I'm sure that the cocktail analogy as a metaphor for corruption is good too. But I'm wondering about if you know of the. I read about a year ago that there was the Veterans Administration had bought a software program, diagnostic software program, and it's supposed to be very good, but it's only, you can't. I've asked doctors I visited in the last year or so, have they heard of it, and some of them say yes, and some say no. But it's supposed to be extremely, it's updated like weekly with recent trials and all this stuff, and I'm wondering if you think that's the future of medicine, where a physician who's not, you know, a physician can't know everything, right, and even your specialty, so... Do you know anything about that, or could you comment on that?
Well, there are two things. First of all, you talked about transparency,
mm-hmm.
and that's a major issue. For example, if we accept a trial, we will only do so if it comes from drug, if it's sponsored by a drug company, we will only do so if all the data have been seen by an independent analyst, statistician, and reanalyzed completely by that person. So that's a little aspect where we try and get against some of the bias. Now, you asked about diagnostic programs. I know that and I'm going to express a lot of ignorance here.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'd say that the VA, the Veterans Administration, has set up a pretty good system, a computer system for trying to get unified charts and to exchange between different VA systems. There have been diagnostic programs around for a very long time, and they depend to a tremendous degree on knowing what the probabilities of a particular disease are at any one time. And they depend on an enormous amount of research that's got nothing to do with electronics or communication or data sharing or anything like that, but it's just the grind of finding out how common all these things are going to be when you step through the various branches of a diagnostic program. But I don't know about the VA one. I'm an ignorant person there.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate your work.
Thanks for the call. Is it, I think, also one of the things that you pointed to as a problem with the system that we have for developing drugs and then following them comes in the follow part, that once a drug is approved and starts to be more widely prescribed, that we apparently don't have a very good system for trying to monitor any problems that come up at that point once we start to have larger numbers of people taking the medication, so that if a problem does develop, we have some way of taking note of it, following it, communicating to physicians who may be prescribing the fact that there may be a problem and they may or may not want to prescribe that drug, or that they might want to think more carefully about their patients and who is going to get it and maybe who should get something else. That we really don't have a good way to do that.
Very well put. Actually, we have a system designed by people who don't want to know the answer. And it goes like this. We have a system of voluntary reporting, which we know captures at most 1 in 100 toxic effects of the drug or bad reactions, at most 1 in 100. Companies often sign agreements as part of the approval, the FDA approval process. They are allowed, they are approved to market the drug, and a condition of that is that they do a phase 4 trial, which is they take careful steps to monitor the toxic effects of the drug, and the good effects as well, but the toxic effects chiefly. 75%, I think, to 80% of the times, they just don't do that. And, of course, the reason given is, well, there is no time set by law to do it, but we're getting on to it.
We'll get around to that, yeah.
We're getting around to it sometime. It's a disgraceful circumstance. Now, if you've got more money than Australia, to take an example, as some of the drug companies have, you can be a scofflaw. For example, a long time ago, it was written into law that that certain trials had to be registered. They narrowed it to dangerous conditions, life-threatening conditions, which they decided were only cancer and HIV. So those people who died of heart attack were out of luck. And studies show that about 99% of government-sponsored studies were registered, and about 40 of those in that small area of cancer, and about 40-something percent or less of drug company-sponsored studies in those areas where law required them to register. So you can be a scofflaw if you've got big enough shoulders and can bully enough.
We have about 5 minutes left, 5-6 minutes left, and three callers will try to get at least a couple in as we continue to talk with our guest, Dr. Drummond Rennie. He is the deputy editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, adjunct professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, here visiting the campus to give the keynote address to this year's symposium on graduate education, focusing this year on the responsible conduct of research. We have next someone to talk with in Champaign, and line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 2 points. One is the interaction. In other words, all these different medications these people are on and the interactions of these drugs, and I know that they're not, they know very little about it. And the second one, at the beginning of the program, you mentioned the Me Too. And, you know, I just think that if there wasn't such Me Too, what advances could have been made medicine, the pharmaceuticals, if there wasn't, and my understanding, you can clarify this, is that in terms of Me Too, all they have to do is show against the placebo that it does a little bit better, or above the placebo, rather than testing against, that certain generation, that it's much better than the one that's already in the market. So I'll just hang up and let you comment. But I love the way you're telling the complete story. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Actually, a lot is known about drug interactions, and that's an area where the databases and electronic information on personal PDAs has been extremely useful to doctors. You can enter your three drugs, two drugs, whatever it is, and see what to be alarmed about. Secondly, the Me Toos, I can't tell you how much. I mean, you said it. You said it. A huge amount of money is spent on these, and it's sad, really. We set the bar so low, and that's a pretty unhappy circumstance nowadays, that we should be doing placebo-controlled trials out there. That's too bad. It's impossible to think that somebody set up this organization that wasn't being paid off by the sponsors. And when you think that there are two or three times as many lobbyists on the Hill as there are senators and members of the House added together, then you get some idea of the thought process and the influence on it.
We are trying to get one more caller, at least. I believe this is in Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hello, is this me?
Well, you are line two. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes.
I wanted to ask the gentleman. I was on a trial. It was sponsored by Novartis, and it was conducted by a local doctor. And I had all kinds of complications. I still am. And I keep writing letters to the doctor and to the drug company. I've had all these tests. I've had all these problems. And I'm not getting any response from either one. Can you help me?
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. People who give their bodies for trials deserve much more than that. I can't say anything about this Novartis trial, and I won't. However, I'd make this general rule that when people get involved in a trial, they sign a contract, and I bet you did, and the company signs a contract. It's also, I think, a great deal more than that. It's a compact as well. Medicine should be a lot more than just signing a contract. If you use somebody, and I've been a patient or a participant in trials myself, if you use somebody for that, you're expecting to boost your profits down the line. But you're this is in the field of medicine, where humanity has to come in. And you owe somebody not just money, you owe them care, attention, respect. That's all I can say about that.
I don't know, caller, if you want to ask a follow-up, I'm not sure that there is a better answer that we can give you.
These complications are costing me a lot of money, and the doctor is refusing to pay, and Novartis is refusing to pay, and they were all as a result of this trial, and I can prove it because I never went to the doctor before the trial about anything except my annual physical. So is there anything I can do?
Madam, you're going to get me into all sorts of trouble. Practicing medicine in the state of Illinois, where I no longer have license, and practicing law without going to law school. What can I say? I'm sure that you have talked with people, professional people, about any remedies, but I'm not advising anything.
Well, in any case, we're going to have to stop because we're at the end of the time. In about 30 seconds, who has the power to put some pressure, and where would you put the pressure if you wanted to try to change some of the problems that you have identified so well and so clearly?
Yeah, the pressure has to be put on the Congress. And what puts pressure on the Congress, I'm sorry to say, are catastrophes. Thalidomide did it once, and I don't want to welcome some catastrophe, but it's going to happen. We don't pay much attention to a catastrophe where thousands and thousands of people are killed from heart attacks because they're buried in all the, literally buried in all the other statistics. But it has to happen through the Congress. That's the only way, and it has to be something dramatic that will overcome the huge money flowing into the Congress.
Well, there, we're going to have to stop. Again, I'd like to tell people that our guest, Dr. Drummond Rennie, is here on the campus of the University of Illinois to give the keynote address in the 6th Annual Symposium on Graduate Education, sponsored by the Graduate College here at the U of I. The event this year dedicated to responsible conduct of research. Dr. Rennie is deputy editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association and also adjunct professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. Dr. Rennie, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.